that away by noting that he'd been a humble staff sergeant squad leader himself before disappearing into the maw of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he regaled them with stories of his former life in the ninjas, stories that the others listened to with a mixture of respect and amusement. As good as the 7th Infantry Division had been, it wasn't this good. Even Domingo would admit to that, after a few pints of John Courage. "Okay, Al, what do you think?" John asked. The liquor cabinet in his office was open, a single malt scotch for Stanley, while Clark sipped at a wild turkey. "The lads," he shrugged, "technically very competent. Marksmanship is just about right, physical fitness is fine. They respond well to obstacles and the unexpected, and, well, they didn't kill us with stray rounds, did they?" "But," Clark asked with a quizzical look, "but one doesn't know until the real thing happens." "Oh, yes, they're as good as SAS, but the best of them are former SAS." Old world pessimism, John Clark thought. That was the problem with Europeans. No optimism. Too often they looked for things that would go wrong instead of right. "Chavez?" "Superb lad," Stanley admitted. "Almost as good as Peter Covington." "Agreed," Clark admitted, the slight on his son-in-law notwithstanding. But Covington had been at Hereford for 7 years. Another couple of months, and Ding would be there. He was pretty close already. It was already down to how many hours of sleep one or the other had had the night before, and pretty soon it would be down to what one or the other had eaten for breakfast. All in all, John told himself, he had the right people, trained to the right edge. Now all he had to do was keep them there. Training, training, training. Neither knew that it had already started. "So, Dmitri," the man said. "Yes, Dmitri," Arkadyevich Popov replied, twirling his vodka around in the glass. "Where and how do we begin?" the man asked. They'd met by a fortunate accident, both thought, albeit for very different reasons. It had happened in Paris, at some sidewalk café, tables right next to each other, where one had noted that the other was Russian, and wanted to ask a few simple questions about business in Russia. Popov, a former KGB official, riffed and scouting around for opportunities for entering the world of capitalism, had quickly determined that this American had a great deal of money, and was therefore worthy of stroking. He had answered the questions openly and clearly, leading the American to deduce his former occupation rapidly. The language skills — Popov was highly fluent in English, French, and Czech — had been a giveaway, as had Popov's knowledge of Washington, D.C. Popov was clearly not a diplomat, being too open and forthright in his opinions, which factor had terminated his promotion in the former Soviet KGB at the rank of colonel. He still thought himself worthy of general stars. As usual, one thing had led to another, first the exchange of business cards, then a trip to America, first class on Air France, as a security consultant, and a series of meetings that had moved ever so subtly in a direction that came more as a surprise to the Russian than the American. Popov had impressed the American with his knowledge of safety issues on the streets of foreign cities. Then the discussion had moved into very different areas of expertise. "How do you know all this?" the American had asked in his New York office. The response had been a broad grin, after 3 double vodkas. "I know these people, of course. Come, you must know what I did before leaving the service of my country." "You actually worked with terrorists?" he'd asked, surprised, and thinking about this bit of information even back then. It was necessary for Popov to explain in the proper ideological context. "You must remember that to us they were not terrorists at all. They were fellow believers in world peace and Marxism-Leninism, fellow soldiers in the struggle for human freedom. And, truth be told, useful fools, all too willing to sacrifice their lives in return for a little support of one sort or another. Really, the American asked again in surprise. I would have thought that they were motivated by something important. Oh, they are, Popoff assured him. But idealists are foolish people, are they not? Some are, his host admitted, nodding for his guest to go on. They believe all the rhetoric, all the promises. Don't you see? I, too, was a party member. I said the words, filled out the Blue Book answers, attended the meetings, paid my party dues. I did all I had to, but really, I was KGB. I traveled abroad. I saw what life was like in the West. I much preferred to travel abroad on, business than to work at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. Better food, better clothes, better everything. Unlike these foolish youths, I knew what the truth was, he concluded, saluting with his half-full glass. So, what are they doing now? Hiding, Popoff answered. For the most part, hiding. Some may have jobs of one sort or another. Probably menial ones, I would imagine, despite the university education most of them have. I wonder.
A sleepy look reflected the man's own imbibing, so skillfully delivered that Popoff wondered if it were genuine or not. Wonder what? If one could still contact them. Most certainly, if there were a reason for it. My contacts, he tapped his temple. Well, such things do not evaporate. Where was this going? Well, Dmitri, you know, even attack dogs have their uses, and every so often, well, an embarrassed smile, you know. In that moment, Popoff wondered if all the movies were true. Did American business executives really plot murder against commercial rivals and such? It seemed quite mad. But maybe the movies were not entirely groundless. Tell me, the American went on, did you actually work with those people? You know, plan some of the jobs they did? Plan? No, the Russian replied, with a shake of the head. I provided some assistance, yes, under the direction of my government. Most often I acted as a courier of sorts. It had not been a favored assignment. Essentially, he'd been a mailman tasked to delivering special messages to those perverse children. But it was duty he'd drawn due to his superb field skills and his ability to reason with nearly anyone on nearly any topic, since the contacts were so difficult to handle once they'd decided to do something. Popoff had been a spook, to use the Western vernacular, a really excellent field intelligence officer who'd never, to the best of his knowledge, been identified by any Western counterintelligence service. Otherwise, his entry into America at JFK International Airport would hardly have been so uneventful. So you actually know how to get in touch with those people, eh? Yes, I do, Popoff assured his host. Remarkable. The American stood. Well, how about some dinner? By the end of dinner, Popoff was earning $100,000 per year as a special consultant, wondering where this new job would lead and not really caring. $100,000 was a good deal of money for a man whose tastes were actually rather sophisticated and needed proper support. It was 10 months later now, and the vodka was still good, in the glass with 2 ice cubes. Where and how? Popoff whispered. It amused him where he was now, and what he was doing. Life was so very strange, the paths you took, and where they led you. After all, he'd just been in Paris that afternoon. killing time and waiting for a meet with a former colleague in DGSE.
When is decided, then?
Yes. You have the date, Dmitri.
I know whom to see and whom to call to arrange the meeting.
You have to do it face to face, the American asked, rather stupidly, Popov thought. A gentle laugh.
My dear friend, yes. Face to face. One does not arrange such a thing with a fax.
That's a risk.
Only a small one. The meet will be in a safe place. No one will take my photograph, and they know me only by a password and code name, and, of course, the currency.
How much?
Popov shrugged.
Oh, shall we say $500,000? In cash, of course. American dollars, Deutschmarks, Swiss francs, that will depend on what our friends prefer, he added, just to make things clear. The host scribbled a quick note and handed the paper across.
That's what you need to get the money.
And with that, things began. Morals were always variable things, depending on the culture, experiences, and principles of individual men and women. In Dmitri's case, his parent culture had few hard and fast rules. His experiences were to make use of that fact, and his main principle was to earn a living.
You know that this carries a certain degree of danger for me, and as you know, my salary...
Your salary just doubled, Dmitri.
A smile.
Excellent.
A good beginning. Even the Russian mafia didn't advance people as quickly as this.
3 times a week they practiced ziplining from a platform, 60 feet down to the ground. Once a week or so they did it for real, out of a British Army helicopter. Chavez didn't like it much. Airborne school was one of the few things he'd avoided in his Army service, which was rather odd, he thought, looking back. He'd done Ranger school as an E-4, but for one reason or another Fort Benning hadn't happened. This was the next best or worst thing. His feet rested on the skids as the chopper approached the drop site. His gloved hands held the rope, 100 feet long in case the pilot misjudged something. Nobody trusted pilots very much, though one's life so often depended on them, and this one seemed pretty good. A little bit of a cowboy. The final part of the simulated insertion took them through a gap in some trees, and the top leaves brushed Ding's uniform, gently, to be sure, but in his position any touch was decidedly unwelcome. Then the nose came up on a powerful, dynamic braking maneuver. Chavez's legs went tight, and when the nose came back down, he kicked himself free of the skid and dropped. The tricky part was stopping the descent just short of the ground, and getting there quickly enough so as not to present yourself as a dangling target. Done. And his feet hit the ground. He tossed the rope free, snatched up his H&K in both hands, and headed off toward the objective, having survived his 14th zipline deployment, the 3rd from a chopper. There was a delightfully joyous aspect to this job, he told himself, as he ran along. He was being a physical soldier again, something he'd once learned to love, and that his CIA duties had mainly denied him. Chavez was a man who liked to sweat, who enjoyed the physical exertion of soldiering in the field, and, most of all, loved being with others who shared his likes. It was hard. It was dangerous. Every member of the team had suffered a minor injury or other in the past month. Except Weber, who seemed to be made of steel. And sooner or later, the statistics said, someone would have a major one, most probably a broken leg from ziplining. Delta at Fort Bragg rarely had a complete team fully mission-capable, due to training accidents and injuries. But hard training made for easy combat. So ran the motto of every competent army in the world. An exaggeration, but not a big one. Looking back from his place of cover and concealment, Chavez saw that Team 2 was all down and moving. Even Vega, remarkably enough. With Oso's upper body bulk, Chavez always worried about his ankles. Weber and Johnston were darting to their programmed perches, each carrying his custom-made scope-sighted rifle. Helmet-mounted radios were working, hissing with the digitized encryption system so that only team members could understand what was being said. Ding turned and saw that everyone was in his pre-briefed position, ready for his next move command. The communications room was on the second floor of the building whose renovations had just been completed. It had the usual number of teletype machines for the various world news services, plus TV sets for CNN and Sky News and a few other broadcasts. These were overseen by people the Brits called minders, who were overseen in turn by a career intelligence officer. The one on this shift was an American from the National Security Agency, an Air Force major who usually dressed in civilian clothes which didn't disguise his nationality or the nature of his training at all. Major Sam Bennett had acclimated himself to the environment. His wife and son weren't all that keen on the local TV, but they found the climate agreeable, and there were several decent golf courses within easy driving distance. He jogged 3 miles every morning to let the local collection of snake-eaters know he wasn't a total wimp, and he was looking forward to a little bird shooting in a few weeks. Otherwise, the duty here was pretty easy. General Clark, that's how everyone seemed to think of him, seemed a decent boss. He liked it clean and fast, which was precisely how Bennett liked to deliver it. Not a screamer, either. Bennett had worked for a few of those in his 12 years of uniformed service. And Bill Tawney, the British intelligence team boss, was about the best Bennett had ever seen. Quiet, thoughtful, and smart. Bennett had shared a few pints of beer with him over the past weeks while talking shop in the Hereford Officers Club. But duty like this was boring most of the time. He'd worked the basement watch center at NSA, a large, low-ceiling room of standard office sheep pens, with mini televisions and computer printers that gave the room a constant low buzz of noise that could drive a man crazy on the long nights of keeping track of the whole fucking world. At least the Brits didn't believe in caging all the worker bees. It was easy for him to get up and walk around. The crew was young here. Only Tawney was over 50, and Bennett liked that, too. "Major," a voice called from one of the news printers, "we have a hostage case in Switzerland." "What service?" Bennett asked on the way over. "Agence France Presse. It's a bank." "A bloody bank," the corporal reported, as Bennett came close enough to read, but couldn't, since he didn't know French. The corporal could, and translated on the fly. Bennett lifted a phone and pushed a button. "Mr. Tawney, we have an incident in Bern. Unknown number of criminals have seized the central branch of the Bern Commercial Bank. There are some civilians trapped inside." "What else, Major?" "Nothing at the moment. Evidently the police are there." "Very well. Thank you, Major Bennett." Tawney killed the line and pulled open a desk drawer to find and open a very special book. Ah, yes, he knew that one. Then he dialed the British Embassy in Geneva. "Mr. Gordon, please," he told the operator. "Gordon," a voice said a few seconds later. "Dennis, this is Bill Tawney." "Bill, haven't heard from you in quite a while. What can I do for you?" the voice asked pleasantly. "Bern Commercial Bank, main branch. There seems to be a hostage situation there. I want you to evaluate the situation and report back to me." "What's our interest, Bill?" the man asked.
We have an understanding with the Swiss government. If their police are unable to handle it, we may have to provide some technical assistance. Who in the embassy liaises with the local police?
Tony Armitage used to be Scotland Yard. Good man for financial crimes and such.
Take him with you, Tawny ordered. Report back directly to me as soon as you have something.
Tawny gave his number.
Very well.
It was a dull afternoon in Geneva anyway.
It will be a few hours.
And it will probably end up as nothing, they both knew.
I'll be here. Thank you, Dennis.
With that, Tawny left his office and went upstairs to watch TV.
Behind the Rainbow Headquarters building were four large satellite dishes trained on communication satellites hovering over the equator. A simple check told them which channel of which bird carried Swiss television satellite broadcasts. As with most countries, it was easier to go up and back to a satellite than to use coaxial landlines. Soon they were getting a direct news feed from the local station. Only one camera was set up at the moment. It showed the outside of an institutional building. The Swiss tended to design banks rather like urban castles, though with a distinctly Germanic flavor to make them appear powerful and forbidding. The voice was that of a reporter talking to his station, not to the public. A linguist stood by to translate.
"No, I have no idea. The police haven't talked to us yet," the translator said in a dull monotone.
Then a new voice came on the line.
"Cameraman," the translator said.
"Sounds like a cameraman. There's something..."
With that, the camera zoomed in, catching a shape. A human shape wearing something over his head, a mask of sorts.
"What kind of gun is that?" Bennett asked.
"Check Model 58," Tawny said at once.
"So it would seem. Bloody good man on the camera."
"What did he say?" That was the studio to the reporter, the translator went on, hardly looking at the picture on the TV screen.
"Don't know. Couldn't hear with all the noise out here. He shouted something, didn't hear it."
"Oh, good. How many people?"
"Not sure. The Wachtmeister said over 20 inside, bank customers and employees. Just me and my cameraman here outside, and about 15 police officers that I can see."
"More on the way, I imagine," reply from the station.
With that, the audio line went quiet. The camera switched off, and shuffling on the audio line told them that the cameraman was moving to a different location, which was confirmed when the picture came back a minute later from a very different angle.
"What gives, Bill?"
Tawny and Bennett turned to see Clark standing there behind them.
"I came over to talk to you, but your secretary said you had a developing situation up here."
"We may," the intelligence section chief replied. "I have the sixth station in Geneva sending two men over now to evaluate it. We do have that arrangement with the Swiss government, should they decide to invoke it. Bennett, is this going out on commercial TV yet?"
Bennett shook his head.
"No, sir. For the moment, they're keeping it quiet."
"Good," Tawny thought.
"Who's the go-team now, John?"
"Team 2, Chavez and Price. They're just finishing up a little exercise right now."
"How long before you think we declare an alert?"
"We could start now," Bill answered, even though it was probably nothing more than a bank robbery gone bad. "They had those in Switzerland, didn't they?"
Clark pulled a mini-radio from his pocket and thumbed it on.
"Chavez, this is Clark. You and Price report to communications right now."
"On the way, 6, was the reply.
"I wonder what this is about," Ding observed to his command sergeant major.
Eddie Price, he'd learned in the past 3 weeks, was as good a soldier as he was ever likely to meet. Cool, smart, quiet, with plenty of field experience.
"I expect we'll find out, sir," Price responded.
Officers felt the need to talk a lot, he knew. Proof of that came at once.
"How long you been in, Eddie?"
Nearly 30 years, sir. I enlisted as a boy soldier, age 15, you see. Parachute regiment, he went on, just to avoid the next question. Came over to SAS when I was 24. Been here ever since. Well, Sergeant Major, I'm glad to have you with me, Chavez said, getting in the car for the drive to the headquarters building.
Thank you, sir, the sergeant major replied.
A decent chap, this Chavez, he thought. Perhaps even a good commander, though that remained to be seen. He could have asked his own questions, but no, that wasn't done, was it? Good as he was, Price didn't know much about the American military yet. "You ought to be an officer, Eddie," Ding didn't say. In America, this guy would have been ripped from his unit, kicking and screaming or not, and shipped off to OCS, probably with a college degree purchased by the Army along the way. Different culture, different rules, Chavez told himself. Well, it gave him a damned good squad sergeant to back him up. 10 minutes later, he parked in the back lot and walked into the building, following directions up to communications. Hey, Mr. C., what gives?
Domingo, there's a chance we may have a job for you and your team. Bern, Switzerland. Bank robbery gone bad. Hostage situation. All we know now.
Clark pointed both of them at the TV screens. Chavez and Price stole swivel chairs and moved them close. If nothing else, it was good as a practice alert. The pre-planned mechanisms were now moving. On the first floor, tickets had already been arranged on no fewer than 4 flights from Gatwick to Switzerland, and 2 helicopters were on the way to Hereford to ferry his men to the airport with their equipment. British Airways had been alerted to accept sealed cargo. Inspecting it for the international flight would just have gotten people excited. If the alert went further, Team 2 members would change into civilian clothes, complete with ties and suit jackets. Clark thought that a little excessive. Making soldiers look like bankers was no easy task, was it?
Not much happening now, Tawny said. Sam, can you roll the tapes from earlier?
Yes, sir.
Major Bennett keyed one up and hit the play button on the remote.
Check 58, Price said immediately. No faces?
Nope, that's the only thing we have on the subjects, Bennett replied.
Odd weapon for robbers, the sergeant major noted. Chavez turned his head. That was one of the things he had yet to learn about Europe. Okay, hoods here didn't use assault rifles.
That's what I thought, Tawny said.
Terrorist weapon? Chavez asked his squad XO.
Yes, sir. The Czechs gave away a lot of them. Quite compact, you see. Only 25 inches long, manufactured by the Uherski Broadworks. 7.6239 Soviet cartridge. Fully automatic. Selector switch.
Odd thing for a Swiss bandit to use, Price said once more for emphasis.
Why? Clark asked.
They make far better weapons in Switzerland, sir, for their territorials. Their citizen soldiers stow them in their closets, you see. Should not be all that difficult to steal several.
The building shook then with the sound of helicopters landing not too far away. Clark checked his watch and nodded approval at the timing.
What do we know about the neighborhood? Chavez asked.
Working on that now, old boy, Tawny answered. So far, just what the TV feed shows.
The TV screen showed an ordinary street devoid of vehicular traffic at the moment because the local police had diverted cars and buses away from the bank. Otherwise, they saw ordinary masonry buildings bordering an ordinary city street. Chavez looked over at Price, whose eyes were locked on the pictures they were getting. 2 now, because another Swiss TV station had dispatched a camera team there, and both signals were being pirated off the satellite. The translator continued to relay the remarks of the camera crews and reporters on the scene to their respective stations.
They said very little, about half of it small talk, that could have been spoken from one desk to another in an office setting. One camera or the other occasionally caught the movement of a curtain, but that was all.
"The police are probably trying to establish communications with our friends on the telephone, talk to them, reason with them, the usual drill," Price said, realizing that he had more practical experience with this sort of thing than anyone else in the room. They knew the theory, but theory wasn't always enough. "We shall know in half an hour if this is a mission for us or not."
"How good are the Swiss cops?" Chavez asked Price.
"Very good indeed, sir, but not a great deal of experience with a serious hostage event."
"That's why we have an understanding with them," Tawney put in.
"Yes, sir."
Price leaned back, reached into his pocket, and took out his pipe.
"Anyone object?"
Clark shook his head.
"No health Nazis here, Sergeant Major."
"What do you mean by a serious hostage event?"
"Committed criminals. Terrorists."
Price shrugged.
"Chaps stupid enough to put their lives behind the chips on the gaming table.
The sort who kill hostages to show their resolve."
"The sort we go in after and kill," Price didn't have to add.
It was an awful lot of brain power to be sitting around doing nothing, John Clark thought, especially Bill Tawney. But if you had no information, it was difficult to make pontifical pronouncements. All eyes were locked on the TV screens, which showed little, and Clark found himself missing the inane drivel that one expected of TV reporters, filling silence with empty words. About the only interesting thing was when they said that they were trying to talk to the local cops, but that the cops weren't saying anything, except that they were trying to establish contact with the bad guys, so far unsuccessfully. That had to be a lie. But the police were supposed to lie to the media and the public in cases like this, because any halfway competent terrorist would have a TV set with him and would have somebody watching it. You could catch a lot by watching TV, else Clark and his senior people would not be watching it either, would they? The protocol on this was both simple and complex. Rainbow had an understanding with the Swiss government. If the local police couldn't handle it, they'd bump it up to the canton, state level, which would then decide whether or not to bump it one more step to the central national government, whose ministerial-level people could then make the rainbow call. That entire mechanism had been established months before as part of the mandate of the agency that Clark now headed. The help call would come through the British Foreign Office in Whitehall, on the bank of the Thames in central London. It seemed like a hell of a lot of bureaucracy to John, but there was no avoiding it, and he was grateful that there was not an additional level or two. Once the call was made, things got easier, at least in the administrative sense. But until the call was made, the Swiss would tell them nothing. 1 hour into the TV vigil, Chavez left to put Team 2 on alert. The troops, he saw, took it calmly, readying gear that needed to be seen to, which was not very much. The TV feed was routed to their individual desktop sets, and the men settled back in their swivel chairs to watch quietly as their boss went back to communications, while the helicopters sat idle on the pad outside Team 2's area. Team 1 went on standby alert as well, in case the helicopters taking 2 to Gatwick crashed. The procedures had been completely thought through. Except, John thought, by the terrorists. On the TV screen, police milled about, some at the ready, most just standing and watching. Trained police or not, they were little trained for a situation like this, and the Swiss, while they had considered such an event, everyone in the civilized world had taken it no more seriously than, say, the cops in Boulder, Colorado. This had never happened before in Bern, and until it did, it would not be part of the local police department's corporate culture. The facts were too stark for Clark and the rest to discount. The German police, as competent as any in the world, had thoroughly blown the hostage rescue at Furstenfeldbruck, not because they had been bad cops, but because it had been their first time. And as a result, some Israeli athletes hadn't made it home from the 1972 Munich Olympiad. The whole world had learned from that, but how much had they learned? Clark and the rest all wondered at the same time. The TV screens showed very little for another half hour beyond an empty city street. But then, a senior police officer walked into the open, holding a cellular phone. His body language was placid at first, but it started to change. And then he held the cell phone close to his ear, seeming to lean into it. His free hand came up about then, placatingly, as though in a face-to-face conversation. "Something's wrong," Dr. Paul Bellow observed, which was hardly a surprise to the others, especially Eddie Price, who tensed in his chair, but said nothing as he puffed on his pipe. Negotiating with people like those controlling the bank was its own little art form, and it was one this police superintendent, whatever his rank was, had yet to learn. Bad news, the sergeant major thought, for one or more of the bank customers. "Was that a shot?" the translator said, relaying the words of one of the reporters on the scene. "Oh, shit," Chavez observed quietly. The situation had just escalated. Less than a minute later, one of the bank's glass doors opened, and a man in civilian clothes dragged a body onto the sidewalk. It seemed to be a man, but his head, as both the cameras zoomed in on the scene from different angles, was a red mass. The civilian got the body all the way outside and froze the moment he set it down. "Move right. Go to your right," Chavez thought as loudly as he could from so far away. Somehow the thought must have gotten there, for the unnamed man in his gray overcoat stood stock still for several seconds, looking down, and then, furtively he thought, went to the right. "Somebody's shouting from inside the bank," the translator relayed. But whatever the voice had shouted, it hadn't been the right thing. The civilian dove to his right, away from the double glass doors of the bank and below the level of the plate glass bank windows. He was now on the sidewalk, with 3 feet of granite block over his head, invisible from the interior of the building. "Good move, old man," Tawny observed quietly. "Now we'll see if the police can get you into the clear." One of the cameras shifted to the senior cop, who'd wandered into the middle of the street with his cell phone, and was now waving frantically for the civilian to get down. Brave or foolish, they couldn't tell, but the cop then walked slowly back to the line of police cars, astonishingly without being shot for his troubles. The cameras shifted back to the escaped civilian. Police had edged to the side of the bank building, waving for the man to crawl, keep low, to where they were standing. The uniformed cops had submachine guns out. Their body language was tense and frustrated. One of the police faces looked to the body on the sidewalk, and the man in Hereford could easily translate his thoughts. "Mr. Tawney, a call for you on line 4," the intercom called. The intelligence chief walked to a phone and punched the proper button. "Tawney?" "Ah, yes, Dennis. Whoever they are, they've just murdered a chap. We just watched it. We are pirating the TV feed." Which meant that Gordon's trip to Bern was a waste of time. But no, it wasn't, was it? "You have that Armitage chap with you?" "Yes, Bill. He's going over to talk to their police now." "Excellent. I will hold for him." As though on cue, a camera showed a man in civilian clothes walking to the senior cop on the scene. He pulled out an ID folder, spoke briefly with the police commander, and walked away, disappearing around the corner.
"This is Tony Armitage. Who's this?"
Bill Tawney.
Well, if you know Dennis, I expect you're a six chap.
What can I do for you, sir?
What did the police tell you?
Tawney hit the speaker switch on the phone.
He's out of his depth by several meters or so. Said he's sending it up to the canton for advice.
Mr. C., Chavez said from his chair.
Tell the choppers to spool up, Ding. You're off to Gatwick. Hold there for further instructions.
Roger that, Mr. C. Team 2 is moving.
Chavez walked down the stairs with Price behind him, then jumped into their car, which had them at Team 2's building in under 3 minutes.
People, if you're watching the telly, you know what's happening. Saddle up. We're choppering to Gatwick.
They just headed out the door when a brave Swiss cop managed to get the civilian to safety. The TV showed the civilian being hustled to a car, which sped off at once. Again, the body language was the important thing. The assembled police, who had been standing around casually, were standing differently now, mainly crouched behind the cover of their automobiles, their hands fingering their weapons, tense but still unsure of what they ought to do.
It's going out live on TV now, Bennett reported. Sky News will have it on in a few.
I guess that figures, Clark said. Where's Stanley?
He's at Gatwick now, Tawney said.
Clark nodded.
Stanley would deploy with Team 2 as field commander. Dr. Paul Bellow was gone as well. He'd chopper out with Chavez and advise him and Stanley on the psychological aspects of the tactical situation. Nothing to be done now but order coffee and solid food, which Clark did, taking a chair and sitting in front of the TVs.
Chapter 3 Gnomes and Guns. The helicopter ride was 25 minutes exactly, and deposited Team 2 and its attachments in the general aviation portion of the International Airport. Two vans waited, and Chavez watched his men load their gear into one of them for movement to the British Airways terminal. There, some cops, who were also waiting, supervised the van's handling into a cargo container, which would be first off the flight when the plane arrived at Bern. But first, they had to wait for the go mission order. Chavez pulled out his cellular phone, flipped it open, and thumbed speed dial number 1.
Clark, the voice said after the encryption software clicked through.
Ding here, John. The call come from Whitehall yet?
Still waiting, Domingo. We expect it shortly. The canton bumped it upstairs. Their justice minister is considering it now.
Well, tell the worthy gentleman that this flight leaves the gate in 20 minutes, and the next one after that is 90 minutes, unless you want us to travel Swiss Air. One of those in 40 minutes. And another in 1:15.
I hear you, Ding. We have to hold.
Chavez swore in Spanish. He knew it. He didn't have to like it.
Roger 6, Team 2 is holding on the ramp at Gatwick.
Roger that, Team 2, Rainbow 6, out.
Chavez closed his phone and tucked it in his shirt pocket.
Okay, people, he said to his men over the shriek of jet engines. We hold here for the go-ahead.
The troops nodded, as eager to get it going as their boss, but just as powerless to make it happen. The British team members had been there before and took it better than the Americans and the others.
Bill, tell Whitehall that we have 20 minutes to get them off the ground. After that, over 1 hour delay.
Tawney nodded and went to a phone in the corner to call his contact in the Foreign Ministry. From there it went to the British ambassador in Geneva, who'd been told that the SAS was offering special mission assistance of a technical nature. It was an odd case where the Swiss foreign minister knew more than the man making the offer. But, remarkably, the word came back in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
We have mission approval, John, Tawney reported, much to his own surprise.
Right. Clark flipped open his own phone and hit the speed dial number 2 button.
Chavez, a voice said over considerable background noise.
We have a go mission, Clark said. Acknowledge. Team 2 copies go mission. Team 2 is moving. That's affirmative. Good luck, Domingo. Thank you, Mr. C.
Chavez turned to his people and pumped his arm up and down in the speeded-up gesture known to armies all over the world. They got into their designated van for the drive across the Gatwick ramp. It stopped at the cargo gate for their flight, where Chavez waved a cop close, and let Eddie Price pass the word to load the special cargo onto the Boeing 757. That done, the van advanced another 50 yards to the stairs outside the end of the jetway, and Team 2 jumped out and headed up the stairs. At the top, the control booth door was held open by another police constable, and from there they walked normally aboard the aircraft and handed over their tickets to the stewardess, who pointed them to their first-class seats. The last man aboard was Tim Noonan, the team's technical wizard. Not a wizened techno-nerd, Noonan had played defensive back at Stanford before joining the FBI, and took weapons training with the team just to fit in. 6 feet, 200 pounds, he was larger than most of Ding's shooters, but, he'd be the first to admit, was not as tough. Still, he was a better-than-fair shot with pistol and MP-10, and was learning to speak the language. Dr. Bellow settled into his window seat with a book extracted from his carry-on bag. It was a volume on sociopathy by a professor at Harvard under whom he'd trained some years before. The rest of the team members just leaned back, skimming through the onboard magazines. Chavez looked around and saw that his team didn't seem tense at all, and was both amazed at the fact and slightly ashamed that he was so pumped up. The airline captain made his announcements, and the Boeing backed away from the gate, then taxied out to the runway. 5 minutes later, the aircraft rotated off the ground, and Team 2 was on its way to its first mission.
In the air, Tawny reported. The airline expects a smooth flight and an on-time arrival in 1 hour 15 minutes.
Great, Clark observed. The TV coverage had settled down. Both Swiss stations were broadcasting continuous coverage now, complete with thoughts from the reporters at the scene. That was about as useful as an NFL pre-game show, though police spokesmen were speaking to the press now. No, they didn't know who was inside. Yes, they'd spoken to them. Yes, negotiations were ongoing. No, they couldn't really say any more than that. Yes, they'd keep the press apprised of developments.
Like hell, John thought.
The same coverage was reported on Sky News, and soon CNN and Fox Networks were carrying brief stories about it, including, of course, the dumping of the first victim and the escape of the one who'd dragged the body out.
"Nasty business, John," Tawny said over his tea. Clark nodded.
"I suppose they always are, Bill."
"Quite."
Peter Covington came in then, stole a swivel chair, and moved it next to the two senior men. His face was locked in neutral, though he had to be pissed, Clark thought, that his team wasn't going. But the team availability rotation was set in stone here, as it had to be.
"Thoughts, Peter?" Clark asked.
"They're not awfully bright.
They killed that poor sod very early in the affair, didn't they?"
"Keep going," John said, reminding all of them that he was new in this business.
"When you kill a hostage, you cross a large, thick line, sir. Once across it, one cannot easily go backwards, can one?"
"So, you try to avoid it?"
"I would. It makes it too difficult for the other side to make concessions. And you bloody need the concessions if you want to get away. Unless you know something the opposition does not. Unlikely in a situation like this."
"They'll ask for a way out? Helicopter?"
"Probably." Covington nodded. "To an airport, commercial aircraft waiting, international crew."
"But to where?"
"Libya, perhaps.
But will Libya allow them in?
Where else might they go?
Russia?
I think not.
The Bekaa Valley in Lebanon is still possible, but commercial aircraft doesn't land there. About the only sensible thing they've done is to protect their identities from the police.
Would you care to wager that the hostage who got out has not seen their faces?
Covington shook his head.
They're not amateurs, Clark objected. Their weapons point to some measure of training and professionalism.
That earned John a nod.
True, sir, but not awfully bright. I would not be overly surprised to learn that they'd actually stolen some currency, like common robbers.
Trained terrorists, perhaps, but not good ones.
And what's a good terrorist, John wondered.
Doubtless a term of art he'd have to learn.
The BA flight touched down 2 minutes early, then taxied to the gate. Deng had spent the flight talking to Dr. Bellow. The psychology of this business was the biggest blank spot in his copybook, and one he'd have to learn to fill in, and soon. This wasn't like being a soldier. The psychology of that job was handled at the general officer level most of the time, the figuring out of what the other guy was going to do with his maneuver battalions. This was squad-level combat, but with all sorts of interesting new elements, Ding thought, flipping his seatbelt off before the aircraft stopped moving. But it still came down to the least common denominator, steel on target. Chavez stood and stretched, then headed aft to the doorway, his game face now on all the way. Out the jetway, between two ordinary civilians who probably thought him a businessman, with his suit and tie. Maybe he'd buy a nicer suit in London, he thought idly, exiting the jetway, the better to fit the disguise he and his men had to adopt when traveling. There was a chauffeur sort of man standing out there, holding a sign with the proper name on it. Chavez walked up to him.
Waiting for us?
Yes, sir. Come with me.
Team 2 followed him down the anonymous concourse, then turned into what seemed a conference room that had another door. In it was a uniformed police officer, a senior one, judging by the braid on his blue blouse.
You are, he said.
Chavez. Ding stuck his hand out.
Domingo Chavez.
Spanish? The cop asked in considerable surprise.
American.
And you, sir?
Robling, Marius,
the man replied, when all the team was in the room and the door closed.
Come with me, please.
Robling opened the far door, which led outside to some stairs. A minute later, they were in a minibus heading past the parked aircraft, then out onto a highway. Ding looked back to see another truck, doubtless carrying their gear.
Okay, what can you tell me?
Nothing new since the first murder. We are speaking with them over the telephone. No names, no identities. They've demanded transport to this airport and a flight out of the country. No destination revealed to us as of yet.
Okay, what did the guy who got away tell you?
There are four of them. They speak German. He says they sound as though it is their primary language, idiomatic, pronunciation, and so forth. They are armed with Czech weapons, and it would seem they are not reluctant to make use of them.
Yes, sir.
How long to get there, and will my men be able to change into their gear?
Robling nodded.
It is arranged, Major Chavez.
Thank you, sir.
Can I speak with the man who got out? Dr. Bellow asked.
My orders are to give you full cooperation.
Within reason, of course.
Chavez wondered what that qualification meant, but decided he'd find out in due course. He couldn't blame the man for being unhappy to have a team of foreigners come to his country to enforce the law. But these were the proverbial pros from Dover, and that was that. His own government had said so. It also occurred to Ding that the credibility of Rainbow now rested on his shoulders.
It would be a hell of a thing to embarrass his father-in-law and his team and his country. He turned to look at his people. Eddie Price, perhaps reading his mind, gave a discreet thumbs up. "Well," Chavez thought, "at least one of us thinks we're ready." It was different in the field, something he'd learned in the jungles and mountains of Colombia years before. And the closer you got to the firing line, the more different it got. Out here, there were no laser systems to tell you who'd been killed. Real red blood would announce that. But his people were trained and experienced, especially Sergeant Major Edward Price. All Ding had to do was lead them into battle. There was a secondary school a block from the bank. The minibus and truck pulled up to it, and Team 2 walked into the gymnasium area, which was secured by 10 or so uniformed cops. The men changed into their gear in a locker room and walked back into the gym, to find Roebling with an additional garment for them to wear. These were pullovers, black like their assault gear. Polizei was printed on them, front and back, in gold lettering rather than the usual bright yellow. A Swiss affectation, Chavez thought, without the smile that should have gone with the observation. "Thanks," Chavez told him. It was a useful subterfuge. With that done, the men and their gear reboarded the minibus for the remainder of their drive. This put them around the corner from the bank, invisible both to the terrorists and the TV news cameras. The long riflemen, Johnson and Weber, were walked to pre-selected perches, one overlooking the rear of the bank building, the other diagonally facing the front. Both men settled in, unfolded the bipod legs on their gun stocks, and started surveying the target building. Their rifles were as individual as the shooters. Weber had a Walther WA-2000, chambered for the 300 Winchester Magnum cartridge. Johnston's was custom-made, chambered for the slightly smaller but faster 7mm Remington Magnum. In both cases, the sharpshooters first of all determined the range to target and dialed it into their telescopic sights, then lay down on the foam mattresses they'd brought. Their immediate mission was to observe, gather information, and report. Dr. Bello felt very strange in his black uniform, complete with body armor and Polizei pullover. But it would help prevent his identification by a medical colleague who caught this event on TV. Noonan, similarly dressed, set up his computer, an Apple PowerBook laptop, and started looking over the building blueprints so that he could input them into his system. The local cops had been efficient as hell. Over a period of 30 minutes, he had a complete electronic map of the target building. Everything but the vault combination, he thought with a smile. Then he erected a whip antenna and transmitted the imagery to the other three computers the team had brought along. Chavez, Price, and Bello walked to the senior Swiss policeman on the scene. Greetings were exchanged, hands shaken. Price set up his computer and put in a CD-ROM disk with photos of every known and photographed terrorist in the world. The man who dragged the body out was one Hans Richter, a German national from Bonn who banked here for his Swiss-based trading business.
"Did you see their faces?" Price asked.
"Yes."
A shaky nod. Herr Richtert had a very bad day to this point. Price selected known German terrorists and started flashing photos.
Yeah, that one. He is the leader."
"You are quite sure?"
"Yes, I am.
Ernst Model, formerly of Bader-Meinhof, disappeared in 1989. Whereabouts unknown." Price scrolled down. 4 suspected operations to date. 3 were bloody failures. Nearly captured in Hamburg, 1987. Killed 2 policemen to make his escape. Communist-trained, last suspected to be in Lebanon.
That sighting report is thin.
Very thin, it would seem.
Kidnapping was his specialty.
Okay.
Price